dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
And you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. As the second anniversary of the September 11th suicide bombing attacks approaches, those events of 2001 continue to be put forward as a justification for the actions of the government by the Bush administration and their captive press. We are being fed a steady diet of propaganda with the goal of keeping us fearful and distracting us from the real story. But truth will out. And tonight on the program, we're going to bear down on the geopolitical agenda that lies behind the war on terrorism and the attacks of 9/11/2001. Fasten your seatbelts and start your tape recorders. We'll hear from a former member of Tony Blair's cabinet who has publicly denounced the war on terrorism as bogus, an independent researcher who has documented the deception and inconsistencies of the 9/11 official story, and a former U.S. Special Forces officer who will explain the workings of a brutal foreign policy based on the bottom line that is able to persist because of systemic deception.
When the pot-bellied beast chase their unwelcome guests.
We'll begin the program with an article that appeared last Friday, September 5th, in the London Guardian. The author is Michael Meacher, who until last June was the United Kingdom's Minister for Environment in Tony Blair's cabinet. He is still a member of the British Parliament. The article I'm about to read you has caused an uproar in the UK because Meacher has smashed through the made-for-public-consumption fictions of both his and our government's motives. The article is titled, "This War on Terrorism is Bogus." The 9/11 attacks gave the U.S. an ideal pretext to use force to secure its global domination. Meacher wrote, "Massive attention has now been given, and rightly so, to the reasons why Britain went to war against Iraq. But far too little attention has focused on why the U.S. went to war, and that throws light on British motives, too. The conventional explanation is that after the Twin Towers were hit, retaliation against al-Qaeda bases in Afghanistan was a natural first step in launching a global war against terrorism. Then, because Saddam Hussein was alleged by the U.S. and U.K. governments to retain weapons of mass destruction, the war could be extended to Iraq as well. However, this theory does not fit all the facts. The truth may be a great deal murkier. We now know that a blueprint for the creation of a global Pax Americana was drawn up for Dick Cheney, now Vice President, Donald Rumsfeld, Defense Secretary, Paul Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld's deputy, Jeb Bush, George Bush's younger brother, and Louis Libby, Cheney's Chief of Staff. The document, entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses, was written in September 2000 by the neoconservative think tank Project for the New American Century, PNAC. The plan shows Bush's cabinet intended to take military control of the Gulf region, whether or not Saddam Hussein was in power. It says, quote, "While the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein," close quote. The PNAC blueprint supports an earlier document attributed to Wolfowitz and Libby, which said the U.S. must, quote, discourage advanced industrial nations from challenging our leadership or even aspiring to a larger regional or global role, close quote. It refers to key allies such as the U.K. as the, quote, most effective and efficient means of exercising American global leadership, close quote. It describes peacekeeping missions as, quote, demanding American political leadership rather than that of the UN. It says, even should Saddam pass from the scene, U.S. bases in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait will remain permanently as, quote, Iran may well prove as large a threat to U.S. interests as Iraq has. It spotlights China for regime change, saying it is time to increase the presence of American forces in Southeast Asia. The document also calls for the creation of U.S. space forces to dominate space and the total control of cyberspace to prevent, quote, enemies using the Internet against the U.S. It also hints that the U.S. may consider developing biological weapons that could, quote, target specific genotypes and may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool, close quote. Finally, written a year before 9/11, it pinpoints North Korea, Syria, and Iran as dangerous regimes and says their existence justifies the creation of a, quote, worldwide command and control system, close quote. This is a blueprint for U.S. world domination. But before it is dismissed as an agenda for right-wing fantasists, it is clear it provides a much better explanation of what actually happened before, during, and after 9/11 than the global war on terrorism thesis. This can be seen in several ways. First, it's clear the U.S. authorities did little or nothing to preempt the events of 9/11. It is known that at least 11 countries provided advance warning to the U.S. of the 9/11 attacks. Two senior Mossad experts were sent to Washington in August 2001 to alert the CIA and the FBI to a cell of 200 terrorists said to be preparing a big operation. This was reported in the Daily Telegraph in the UK on September 16, 2001. The list they provided included the names of four of the 9/11 hijackers, none of whom was arrested. It had been known as early as 1996 that there were plans to hit Washington targets with airplanes. Then, in 1999, a U.S. National Intelligence Council report noted that, quote, Al-Qaeda suicide bombers could crash land an aircraft packed with high explosives into the Pentagon, the headquarters of the CIA, or the White House, close quote. 15 of the 9/11 hijackers obtained their visas in Saudi Arabia. Michael Springman, the former head of the American Visa Bureau in Jeddah, stated that since 1987, the CIA had been illicitly issuing visas to unqualified applicants from the Middle East and bringing them to the United States for training in terrorism for the Afghan War in collaboration with bin Laden, reported on the BBC, November 6, 2001. It seems this operation continued after the Afghan War for other purposes. It is also reported that five of the hijackers received training at secure U.S. military installations in the 1990s. Newsweek, September 15, 2001. Instructive leads prior to 9/11 were not followed up. French-Moroccan flight student Zacharias Massaoui, now thought to be the 20th hijacker, was arrested in August 2001 after an instructor reported he showed a suspicious interest in learning how to steer large airliners. When U.S. agents learned from French intelligence he had radical Islamist ties, they sought a warrant to search his computer, which contained clues to the September 11th mission. London Times, November 3rd, 2001. But they were turned down by the FBI. One agent wrote, a month before 9/11, that Massawi might be planning to crash into the Twin Towers. Newsweek, May 20th, 2002. All of this makes it all the more astonishing, on the war on terrorism perspective, that there was such slow reaction on September 11th itself. The first hijacking was suspected at not later than 8:20 a.m., and the last hijacked aircraft crashed in Pennsylvania at 10:06 a.m. Not a single fighter plane was scrambled to investigate from the U.S. Andrews Air Force Base, just 10 miles from Washington, D.C., until after the third plane had hit the Pentagon at 9:38 a.m. Why not? There were standard FAA intercept procedures for hijacked aircraft before 9/11. Between September 2000 and June 2001, the U.S. military launched fighter aircraft on 67 occasions to chase suspicious aircraft. Associated Press, August 13, 2002. It is a U.S. legal requirement that once an aircraft has moved significantly off its flight plan, fighter planes are sent up to investigate. Was this an action simply the result of key people disregarding or being ignorant of the evidence? Or could U.S. air security operations have been deliberately stood down on September 11th? If so, why, and on whose authority? The former U.S. federal crimes prosecutor John Loftus has said, quote, "The information provided by European intelligence services prior to 9/11 was so extensive that it is no longer possible for either the CIA or FBI to assert a defense of incompetence," close quote. Nor is the U.S. response after 9/11 any better. No serious attempt has ever been made to catch bin Laden. In late September and early October 2001, leaders of Pakistan's two Islamist parties negotiated bin Laden's extradition to Pakistan to stand trial for 9/11. However, a U.S. official said significantly that, quote, "Casting our objectives too narrowly," quote, "risked a," quote, "premature collapse of the international effort if by some lucky chance Mr. bin Laden was captured," close quote. The U.S. chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Myers, went so far as to say that, quote, "the goal has never been to get bin Laden," quoted in Associated Press on April 5, 2002. The whistleblowing FBI agent Robert Wright told ABC News on December 19, 2002, that FBI headquarters wanted no arrests, and in November 2001, the U.S. Air Force complained it had al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders in its sights as many as 10 times over the previous 6 weeks, but had been unable to attack because they did not receive permission quickly enough. Time Magazine, May 13, 2002. None of this assembled evidence, all of which comes from sources already in the public domain, is comparable with the idea of a real, determined war on terrorism. And I'm reading from an article published in the London Guardian, written by British Member of Parliament Michael Meacher, saying this war on terrorism is bogus. And the article continues. The catalog of evidence does, however, fall into place when set against the PNAC blueprint. From this, it seems that the so-called war on terrorism is being used largely as a bogus cover for achieving wider U.S. strategic geopolitical objectives. Indeed, Tony Blair himself hinted at this when he said to the Commons Liaison Committee, quote, "To be truthful about it, there was no way we could have got the public consent to have suddenly launched a campaign on Afghanistan but for what happened on September 11th, quoted in the London Times of July 17, 2002. Similarly, Rumsfeld was so determined to obtain a rationale for an attack on Iraq that on 10 separate occasions he asked the CIA to find evidence linking Iraq to 9/11. The CIA repeatedly came back empty-handed. Time Magazine, May 13, 2002. In fact, 9/11 offered an extremely convenient pretext to put the PNAC plan into action. The evidence again is quite clear that plans for military action against Afghanistan and Iraq were in hand well before 9/11. A report prepared for the U.S. government from the Baker Institute of Public Policy stated in April 2001 that, quote, "The U.S. remains a prisoner of its energy dilemma. Iraq remains a destabilizing influence to the flow of oil to international markets from the Middle East," close quote. Submitted to Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Group, the report recommended that because this was an unacceptable risk to the U.S., quote, "military intervention was necessary." Sunday Herald, October 6, 2002. Similar evidence exists in regard to Afghanistan. The BBC reported September 18, 2001, that Niaz Nayak, a former Pakistan foreign secretary, was told by senior American officials at a meeting in Berlin in mid-July 2001 that, quote, "military action against Afghanistan would go ahead by the middle of October." Until July 2001, the U.S. government saw the Taliban regime as a source of stability in Central Asia that would enable the construction of hydrocarbon pipelines from the oil and gas fields in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, through Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Indian Ocean. But confronted with the Taliban's refusal to accept U.S. conditions, the U.S. representatives told them, quote, "Either you accept our offer of a carpet of gold, or we bury you under a carpet of bombs." Close quote. Interpress Service, November 15, 2001. Given this background, it is not surprising that some have seen the U.S. failure to avert the 9/11 attacks as creating an invaluable pretext for attacking Afghanistan in a war that had clearly already been well planned in advance. There is a possible precedent for this. The U.S. National Archives reveal that President Roosevelt used exactly this approach in relation to Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Some advance warning of the attacks was received, but the information never reached the U.S. fleet. The ensuing national outrage persuaded a reluctant U.S. public to join the Second World War. Similarly, the PNAC blueprint of September 2000 states that the process of transforming the U.S. into, quote, "tomorrow's dominant force" is likely to be a long one in the absence of, quote, "some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor," close quote. The 9/11 attacks allowed the U.S. to press the go button for a strategy in accordance with the PNAC agenda, which it would otherwise have been politically impossible to implement. The overriding motivation for this political smokescreen is that the U.S. and the U.K. are beginning to run out of secure hydrocarbon energy supplies. By 2010, the Muslim world will control as much as 60% of the world's oil production, and even more importantly, 95% of remaining global oil export capacity. As demand is increasing, so supply is decreasing continually since the 1960s. This is leading to increasing dependence on foreign oil supplies for both the U.S. and the U.K. The U.S., which in 1990 produced domestically 57% of its total energy demand, is predicted to produce only 39% of its needs by 2010. A DTI minister has admitted that the U.K. could be facing severe gas shortages by 2005. The U.K. government has confirmed that 70% of our electricity will come from gas by 2020, and 90% of that will be imported. In that context, it should be noted that Iraq has 110 trillion cubic feet of gas reserves in addition to its oil. A report from the Commission on America's National Interests in July 2000 noted that the most promising new source of world supplies was the Caspian region, and this would relieve U.S. dependence on Saudi Arabia. To diversify supply routes from the Caspian, one pipeline would run westward via Azerbaijan and Georgia to the Turkish port of Ceyhan. Another would extend eastward through Afghanistan and Pakistan and terminate near the Indian border. This would rescue Enron's beleaguered power plant at Dabhol on India's west coast, in which Enron had sunk $3 billion worth of investment and whose economic survival was dependent on access to cheap gas. Nor has the UK been disinterested in this scramble for the remaining world supplies of hydrocarbons, and this may partly explain British participation in U.S. military actions. Lord Brown, chief executive of British Petroleum, warned Washington not to carve up Iraq for its own oil companies in the aftermath of war, Guardian, October 30, 2002. And when a British foreign minister met Gaddafi in his desert tent in August 2002, it was said that, quote, the UK does not want to lose out to other European nations already jostling for advantage when it comes to potentially lucrative oil contracts with Libya. BBC Online, August 10, 2002. The conclusion of all this analysis must surely be that the global war on terrorism has the hallmarks of a political myth propagated to pave the way for a wholly different agenda. The U.S. goal of world hegemony, built around securing by force command over oil supplies required to drive the whole project. Is collusion with this myth and junior participation in this project really a proper aspiration for British foreign policy? If there was ever a need to justify a more objective British stance driven by our own independent goals, this whole depressing saga surely provides all the evidence needed for a radical change of course. And I have been reading an article from former UK Minister of Environment and present Member of Parliament, Michael Meacher. The article was titled, This War on Terrorism is Bogus, and was published Friday, September 5th in the London Guardian.
I don't have to depend on you anymore. Don't have to give you my support. You don't have to go drill that tundra for me, 'cause I'm disengaging, I'm separating from the oil company. And now I got a diesel, biodiesel. I got a biodiesel van. Diesel, diesel, biodiesel. I got a biodiesel van. You don't have to be smart to know one thing's for sure. It's about that oil that our government keeps waging these sickly wars. And I've filled up my tank so many times I start to feel cruel. How much I spend it, how I depend it on that polluted fossil fuel.
Independent researcher Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed has published a carefully annotated book with over 600 footnotes. War on Freedom explores every aspect of the 9/11 attacks. To the shock of many readers of his book, Mr. Ahmed concludes that the attacks were widely anticipated within the U.S. intelligence community and were therefore preventable. He also posits that some in the Bush administration may have actually allowed the attacks to proceed in order to achieve certain political aims. I spoke with Mr. Ahmed in February at his home in Brighton, England. In this first part of our interview, Mr. Ahmed discusses the failure of the U.S. Air Force to follow standard emergency procedures in response to the hijacked aircraft on 9/11.
Yeah, I mean, basically, a Federal Aviation Administration has various standard operating procedures to respond to anything that happens in the skies, and not just to respond, but to deal with putting commercial planes up in the skies. I mean, so like a commercial plane has a fixed flight path. I mean, they've got thousands of planes in the sky, so they have to make sure that everything is organized. If a plane's on a path, it will go down that path. If it deviates from that path, and it's not supposed to deviate, then that's considered an emergency, and they contact the pilot to find out why he's deviating or what's gone wrong. And for example, sometimes they can resolve the situation, or if they can't, then, for example, they might not be able to establish radio contact. If they can't, for whatever reason, actually stop the plane from deviating, they will have to send up a military jet to intercept that flight to find out and assess the situation. And that military jet would also act, they have the various communications procedures they've got, like there's various wingtip movements they have to try and communicate with the pilot if they can't establish radio contact. So they'll try to communicate that way as well. In general, they'll assess the situation, and then they'll try to see what they can do after that. Can they, if it's, say, a hijacking scenario, can they force the plane to move into a certain position or move out of a certain airspace? They've done that sometimes over Washington airspace or New York airspace. Can they do something else? You know, and they have, as a last resort, there's always been there for quite a few years, this idea of the possibility of shooting down a plane. And I think a typical example was the Learjet, that was Payne Stewart's, the golfer's, his jet when it went off course. I think they had all suffocated and literally had died within a few minutes, and the plane had gone off course, and it was basically, they were flying over a very low populated area, and I remember reading the report, the FAA had seen what was going on and said, okay, we don't have to act too fast on this, because it's not happening over a high populated area, and it's just a private jet, but we'll send up our military interceptors. Within half an hour, they had, even though it was a low scale emergency situation, within half an hour they had the military jet tracking the plane, and the reports from ABC News and all the rest of it, they all show that basically multiple jets continued to replace each other to make sure that they were on the trail of the Learjets, and they scrambled them from different Air Force bases. Otis Air Force Base, Langley, whatever, I can't even remember now. Different Air Force bases, just to make sure that they could track the plane and keep an eye on it. And in the end, they couldn't do very much about it. They let it crash. But that example shows like what a general standard response is in a very low-scale emergency. You know, we've got this half an hour response time between finding out what's happened and getting the plane up there, and that's for a low-scale emergency when they know there's not any massive danger to civilian life. And 9/11, there's different reports about what happened, and we have to take into account the mandatory nature of the standard procedures when we analyse that. The early reports say that no planes were scrambled at all until after the Pentagon was hit. And those reports, in my view, are more credible. And I'll go into that a bit in due course. Richard Myers, who is acting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on 9/11, he testified before the Senate on 15th September. He basically said that they asked him, you know, why the hell didn't we manage to do anything? You know, we've got the best air defense system in the world and we didn't do anything. What happened? And when did we scramble planes? And so he said, he told them three times in his testimony that we only managed to scramble planes until after the Pentagon was hit. So that was one testimony that was very crucial and very authoritative. There was another testimony from a guy called Mike Snyders, who is a spokesman for NORAD, which is the main agency involved in basically tracking aircraft and liaising with the Pentagon to tell them which one, where, when they should scramble and what. And basically, this guy Mike Snyders, who's he's a major general, and he was quoted in the Boston Globe. It was a few days after September, basically saying exactly the same thing, that we only managed to scramble planes until after the Pentagon was hit. And it's interesting because he also said at the same time that it's quite routine for us to intercept planes. It's nothing special. We do it all the time. And the third testimony, I think there are others as well, but the third one was actually from Dick Cheney, obviously the vice president, and he came on MSNBC again a few days after September 11th. He did an interview with Tim Russert, and he basically, the transcript is, I think, is still available online, and he basically just said, the guy asked him again, you know, why didn't we scramble planes, tell me about, they were generally talking about the whole chronology of events on that day, what was Dick Cheney's experience, and he also asked him, why did we not manage to scramble craft in time to protect the Pentagon, and Dick Cheney said, you know, yeah, you're right, we didn't manage to do that. And then he went on to try and give an explanation as to why, etc., etc. But, I mean, so we have these three early testimonies, very authoritative, coming from key people involved, who basically said that we didn't scramble planes until after the Pentagon was hit. And if we look at that, it's about 1 hour and 20 minutes, or 1.5 hours, since the first plane was hijacked, and since the FAA knew about that. And which is extraordinary, you know, because it's standard procedures, and anyone can see that. If they look at the FAA manuals, as soon as they know there's an emergency, they should immediately scramble planes if they can't deal with it in any other way. And even if they're unsure about the nature of the emergency, there's a specific clause which says if you don't know whether it is an emergency, treat it as if it is an emergency. So they can't say, oh, we didn't know it was a hijacking, we weren't sure. As soon as you lose radio contact and that plane is deviating, the planes must be up. You don't have to know that there's four planes. You don't have to know that they're going to the World Trade Center. You just have to know that they're up there and they're not on their flight paths. And obviously, as the events progressed and as it became very clear after 20 minutes that four planes were in the skies hijacked, then, you know, it would have been, this is an unprecedented emergency, and for them to not scramble planes is very extraordinary, you know, when you have these standard procedures. And so I think it was about a week or 2 weeks later that it seems that someone up there looked at that and thought, bloody hell, these idiots have come out and told the truth. Now we need to basically say we did scramble planes, because otherwise someone's going to start asking hard questions. And so there was this official timeline released by the Department of Defense that was then put out by CNN and everyone else, all the major other media, which basically said that they did scramble planes. And you can see they kind of the timeline is very nice. They kind of put that you can. They thought about it very carefully, where they put this 10-minute gap here, a 10-minute gap there, and a 10-minute gap here before. And even if you look at those 10-minute gaps, you think, okay, the FAA contacted NORAD to tell them that we need to scramble planes, and 10 minutes later they scrambled the plane. Why 10 minutes later? What were they waiting for? You know, I mean, scramble times happen within minutes. This is an emergency. You go. That's what happens normally. And why didn't you do this on a day when we have this unprecedented emergency? When you do it all the time. I mean, it was. I think it was Mary Schiavo, who was a former. She was in the Department of Transport in the first Bush administration, and she basically just said, you know, we've had thousands of hijackings over decades in the United States, and we respond to them all the time. What's new? You know, and she wasn't suggesting anything else. She wasn't even talking about the response times. But her testimony is important because when we put it in context, that this is quite standard. It's quite routine. Why didn't we do anything on 9/11? And yeah, and so really, and there was that people have actually analysed that timeline as well, and there are inconsistencies in the timeline, or if not inconsistencies, more kind of it doesn't basically alleviate the problem that they seem to be trying to alleviate, because I think they've claimed that they scrambled planes from Otis Air Force Base, and they scrambled planes from Langley Air Force Base, I think. Cape Cod, maybe, I can't remember, to be honest. But there's two different problems with this whole narrative. The first problem, and Jared Israel was really, he was the first guy, I think, who actually brought this out, is that in Washington, D.C., there is an Air Force Base, Andrews Air Force Base, which is manned. And interestingly, on September 11th, and I think literally a day or 2 days after September 11th, on the website of the Andrews Air Force Base, they had this all this stuff there about how we have so many fighter squadrons there who are ready and capable of scrambling immediately in the case of a national emergency. That was the general thrust. And there's other experts who've mentioned this issue of Andrews Air Force Base. And they're obviously right next to what's happening. You know, they're in Washington and the Pentagon was attacked. And they weren't scrambled. There was nothing. And then we had multiple reports coming out on the same day contradicting each other about why planes weren't scrambled. I mean, USA Today had in one newspaper two separate reports. One of them saying, quoting a Department of Defense official, saying that we didn't have any Air Force at Andrews. You know, there were no planes there manned, so nothing happened. And the same newspaper is another article, I think somewhere near the back, basically quoting someone from the Air Force base saying that we took over in the skies after the Pentagon was hit. We were in the skies. We weren't doing nothing. You know, so you know, either there were planes there or there weren't. Either you were ready to scramble or you weren't. What's the real story? So that's one thing. Why didn't they scramble Andrews planes, you know, which are much closer to the crisis, at least that was going on near the Pentagon? Then the other thing is the issue of the response, the speed of the response of the planes scrambled from Otis and Langley or Cape Cod. I can't remember if Cape Cod was one of them. And there was a report in this kind of free, I think it's a free alternative newspaper distributed in New York, called the New York Press. And this guy, his name's George Samuli, and he's really he's a veteran journalist. He was very big here in the UK. He worked with the Times, he worked with many other newspapers, and he's pretty big in the States. He's got a lot of consultancy positions, etc., etc. And he wrote this piece analysing the response of the Air Force, and he also drew on Jared Israel's work. And he mentioned this really specific point, that looking at the speeds of the planes scrambled from Otis and the other Air Force base, someone seems to have been putting on the brakes, because F-16s or F-15s, they can fly at, I can't remember what the speed was, over 1,000 miles per hour or something, or kilometers per hour, I don't even know. And they were flying at a third of, according to this timeline, it took them this long to get to the World Trade Center and to the Pentagon. They were flying at a third of their maximum speed. Why were they flying at a third of the maximum speed? This was an emergency. You know, you're not just cruising along, enjoying the flight. You know, what does that imply? You know, so even if we take the narrative which has then been released, the official narrative of the Department of Defense, which seems to have been designed to erase what was originally revealed, we find this dire anomaly of someone slowing down the planes and not allowing planes to get there on time. Was it criminal negligence? You know, was it gross incompetence? Was it someone saying, we're going to have a kind of stand down here, an effective stand down on the planes? Who knows? But either way, we have this anomaly and no one's asking questions. So it's really unclear as to where this actual breakdown of the standard procedures occurred. It's not clear at all what happened. What I've tried to do in the book is use bits and pieces of information to pinpoint where high-level officials seem to have been, in some sense, responsible for that breakdown. Because I think on the lower scale, it's actually a bit of a mess to find out what happened. And one of the things I've seemed to have located is that President Bush was really, really heavily involved in this, what someone might call a stand down, you know. It was Dick Cheney, again, on MSNBC, who actually said that when Tim Russert asked him about this whole failure of US air defense, and Dick Cheney went to this whole kind of explanation about, you know, well, you know, we were worried about shooting down a plane, and no one wanted to shoot down planes, and that's why we were really worried about what to do. And but one of the key things he said is that it was the decision to scramble aircraft, and I think this is almost an exact quote, was a presidential-level decision. And we discussed this. You know, it was something that was discussed by the president with his aides, with members of the White House staff, including, it seemed, Dick Cheney. And it was a presidential-level decision to scramble aircraft. And finally, he again said, you know, that the president made the decision to put combat air patrol in the skies over New York. And he skirted around the issue by kind of trying to explain why it was so late, by saying that he kind of confused the two issues of shooting down a plane with intercepting the commercial craft. That was how he seemed to explain that there was this worry about having to shoot down a plane. But what was important about what he said was this confirmation from the vice president that the decision was made by the president to scramble the craft. So what happens then is that we have this direct chain there between the behavior of the US Air Force and the president and the White House. The decision was a presidential level decision. That's it. You know, the failure was a presidential level decision. I've really brought that out in the book and focused on that and said, well, you know, what the hell does that mean for what the president did, you know? And then I've tried to look at the chronology of the president's behavior, which compounds that. And there are a few reports which I don't mention in this edition of the book. I'm planning a second edition, I've almost finished it, and I don't know when we'll be releasing that. In the second edition, I kind of look at a few more aspects of President Bush's behavior. And I think it's useful to look at that. I mean, we've been told that the first time the president was kind of heard about the attacks was when he was sitting in the classroom. And Andrew Card, his chief of staff, went in there and said, whispered in his ear, in the classroom, and brought the TV footage that, you know, America's under attack, blah, blah, blah. And that was supposedly the first time he was told. And what we actually now know on the record is that that was not the case. ABC News, on the morning of 9/11, actually went up to President Bush, and the footage is there and it's available, that President Bush had come out of his hotel on the morning of the attacks, literally about 8, I think it was about 8:53, something like that. This was just after the World Trade Center had been hit. And the journalist, went up to the President just before he was getting into his car and asked him, do you know what's going on in New York? And the President replied, yes, I do, and you're going to have something on it later, as in a statement or something. And he just got in his car and drove off. And Andrew Card, at that time, who was with him, whispered something in his ear. And then they got in the car and they drove off. They drove to the Booker Elementary School in Florida. And over there, we have MSNBC has a whole chronology of what happened after that, which I read on the website. And basically, it quotes a teacher or a principal of the school who was, you know, just watching things as they unfolded. And he basically said that the president arrived, the car pulled up, the president got out. Immediately he got on the phone. And after he got off the phone, he told the teacher that, I just spoke to my national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, and the World Trade Center has been hit. And but it's okay, the show's going to go on. We're going to just carry on as everything has been planned. And so the guy literally said that he got the impression that it was like a brick had fallen off the World Trade Center or something. You know, it was just one of those things, and it's not a big deal. That was literally the impression he got from the president. And then they got inside the classroom or whatever and carried on with the show. And then we have the footage of Andrew Card then coming in about a few minutes later, telling him that the second tower had been hit. So this was the third time, really, that the president had been informed of what was going on. And as we know, the president kind of looked up, gave some kind of ambiguous response, and then carried on talking and listening to the children. And from there onwards, according to this chronology, when he left the classroom, he immediately went to the hall, where he then delivered a speech where he basically announced publicly and officially that America is under attack, and this is really, really bad, and, you know, we're going to have to do something about it. And so we look at that, and then we see constantly this whole air of complete indifference to what is going on. And we also have this impression that the president is being kept fully informed of events as they proceed. And we have to remember that the president, he always travels with his national security staff, the Secret Service and all the rest of them, who have they're constantly in touch with all the relevant federal agencies. So as soon as anything had happened, they would have known. And it was interesting because Dick Cheney on MSNBC also confirmed that at least as soon as the first tower was hit, the Secret Service had open lines with the FAA. And that's the latest when they would have known what was going on. And to top that off, the MSNBC report goes further and makes it even worse for the president. Oh no, it's not the it's not the NBC report, it's something else. The president delivered a speech at a town hall in Florida a few days after the attacks, and I think it was publicized quite a bit. This young kid called Jordan stood up and asked the president a question. He asked him about how, you know, America, it's the same question everyone always asks, that America is the strongest military in the world, and why didn't we manage to defend ourselves on 9/11? And so, and what was your response on 9/11? What did you do? And the president said, and the transcript, I read this on the website of the White House, whitehouse.gov, and its official press release, which was distributed to the press. And he basically said, you know, when I found out about the attacks, you know, I realized that I really had to find out what the facts were before doing anything, because there were all sorts of rumors floating around. Many of them were erroneous, and obviously a rumor, you know, is not likely to be erroneous. And he said, therefore, before doing anything, I realized as the commander-in-chief that I had to find out the facts. And obviously as a commander-in-chief, I realized my crucial responsibility to act. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. And then he said, so to find out the facts, what I did is I got on the phone on Air Force One and I spoke to my defense secretary. And then he told me what was going on and everything. And then I ordered him to put the military on alert. And that was when they put the military on alert. And so when we look at that, we ask the question, so when the hell was he on the phone on Air Force One? He was on the phone after the attacks occurred. He was on Air Force One. Everything had already happened, you know. Thousands of people were already basically killed, murdered. And now he was on the phone on Air Force One discussing with his defense secretary and had then decided, okay, now let's put the military on alert. What happened to the military during all that time? What happened to the standard operating procedures for about 1.5 hours before when the first planes were hijacked, when the planes were first hijacked? And so we connect that with the testimony from Dick Cheney that it was a presidential level decision to scramble planes. And we have this picture now emerging of this kind of top level negligence, almost deliberate negligence on the part of the president, on the part of various other actors in the administration, the defense secretary, even Dick Cheney, who seemed to have been involved in this whole process, where there was this almost not doing anything on the part of the military in violation of their normal standard procedures, and suddenly the military was put on alert. Now, a normal rational person would look at that and would look at the facts and say, okay, that looks like a stand down. And it doesn't look nice. It's not what anybody would like to see. And to be honest, when I read Jared Israel's stuff on the US Air Force. I had skim read it, and I just forgot about it and thought, this is rubbish. I don't know, this is complete rubbish. I forget about this. And I only came back to it a few months later after reading other stuff and looking at that and saying, okay, I remember Jared Israel was saying stuff like this before. And so then I started looking into it myself. So it is very hard to accept that maybe there was some kind of direct role played by the administration in allowing what happened on 9/11 to occur. But that appears to be a plausible explanation or a plausible and coherent interpretation of their own behavior. And maybe it's not. Maybe there was this complete and utter gross incompetence for which they should be indicted and for which he should be impeached. But either way, it's not very good. A minimal interpretation of responsibility would be to say that the president was... It's hard. I think it's a very tenuous interpretation, is to say that for some reason, these various agencies, the Secret Service, the FAA, NORAD, etc., not only did they realize the president had this key role, I mean, for example, he had the decision to shoot down a plane, and no one at any time until after the attacks actually asked him, do you want to do this or not? You know, and he didn't bother asking either. And so we have this negligence amongst all of them about what they're supposed to do. Everyone knows the procedures, and no one adheres to them. They just carry on going along with the day's events. Military is standing down, and suddenly they put the military on alert, and the president says, I did it. And Dick Cheney says, yeah, we did it. And the defense secretary is agreeing to that as well. The only interpretation one can give of that is either we have this complete institutional incompetence, which is so severe that it affects all these agencies simultaneously with regards to these basic procedures which they normally just follow. You know, and this is a really gross level of incompetence, in which case, just go through all these agencies, get rid of everyone, start training some people up, looking at these flaws in these agencies, and just get rid of this entire administration, impeach them all, you know. That's the kind of hard measures we have to take. Or we look at another interpretation, which probably will have a very similar kind of measure to take as well, which is that this was something deliberate. Elements of these agencies, high-level elements, including the president, orchestrated a failure by basically orchestrating negligence. It was a kind of orchestrated negligence, one might say. In my view, that's more plausible, simply because I don't believe that the US government or their agencies are that incompetent. Yeah, everyone has... There's always bureaucracy and incompetence, but on issues of national security and issues of protecting the commander-in-chief and, you know, it's really absurd at face value just to say that this was pure incompetence. I mean, if it was, how come this kind of incompetence has never occurred before? How come we've never seen signs of it on this scale before? It doesn't make sense.
Mr. Ahmed has also suggested that by permitting the 9/11 attacks, Bush administration officials could expect intense public outcry and demands for revenge. As with Pearl Harbor, such an event could result in American public support for foreign military action. Such public sentiment may have enabled the invasions of Afghanistan and then Iraq. To some readers of the book, War on Freedom helps explain the current war on terror. In this portion of the interview, we take you back months and years prior to September 11, 2001. We discuss the abundance of the official intelligence which warned of an attack like the 9/11 attack, and we discuss the 9/11 attack and how it benefited the Bush administration's strategic goals in Muslim South Asia. We asked Ahmed why people might question the Bush administration's position that it had no advance knowledge of an impending attack.
One thing I would focus on was how Condoleezza Rice came out and said that we never knew that planes could be used as bombs. You know, how could anybody have known this? It's not imaginable. And this was something that everyone was saying. The whole administration was saying this repeatedly. And then I found reports, and a lot of people, it's widely available, that they knew about this since 1995. You know, that this was actually, I mean, Project Bodinka, this plan hatched by Al-Qaeda to basically hold planes as bombs. There were two parts to the plan, and one of them was to actually hijack civilian planes and target specific structures in the United States. And they had a whole list of the Sears Tower, the World Trade Center, New York Stock Exchange, etc., etc. So stuff like that really just made me think, why are they lying, and what have they got to hide? And so I would probably start talking about something like that, which shows one, administration has lied about that. So why, what are they trying to hide and why are they lying? And so then we'd open the gates and then move further into mm-hmm. other reports, which, you know, are even worse.
Okay. Well, let's start there.
Okay. Okay. I mean, I think apart from that, there's, I think, about two or three bits of information which are, I think, alone are very, very dire in their implications. I think the first very interesting bit of information was from David Shippers, which obviously he was a chief investigative counsel responsible for impeaching Bill Clinton, and he did a couple of radio interviews with minor stations in the States, where he claimed that he had been contacted by several FBI agents prior to, long before 9/11, in May 2001. And that having been contacted by them, he was told that investigations into terrorist activity in the United States were being blocked. And there was immense frustration, not only felt by these guys, but according to them, by their colleagues. And they wanted Shippers to basically, because of his prior experience, because of his standing, he was quite a well-known public figure and quite respected and a lot of connections, if he could pressure Ashcroft or someone else powerful within the US government to actually do something and prevent this block, because they were very worried. They actually believed there was going to be a terrorist attack. They told him that there was going to be an imminent attack on Lower Manhattan, and they specifically mentioned planes being used as bombs. So that was really, really shocking, and I didn't actually hardly believed it, to be honest. I read the transcripts just on the internet, and I actually wanted to get in touch with him, so I called him up. I found his office number and called him up and spoke to him. And he's quite friendly. He was quite helpful. And he confirmed everything that was in the interviews. And what actually happened is that he tried to get in touch with John Ashcroft. He called him by the office, normal office kind of line, and he didn't manage to get through. He only got through to an underling or something, who told him that these investigations only start at the top. You know, we can't just listen to you and then do something. In the end, the guy promised that he would tell Ashcroft that this is what you're saying, and Ashcroft will get back to you, which Ashcroft didn't do that. He also tried to get through to Ashcroft through personal contacts and friends who knew Ashcroft, and it just didn't work. And he felt he was just banging on the door, and he just wasn't answering, and he doesn't know why. He did contact other people as well. I can't remember their names. There was one guy who, I think he was head of the Congress at that time, and so he knew about this as well, but nothing happened, basically. And to me, that in itself shows that there is, it's quite clearly that there was, and especially with the subsequent testimonies that have been coming out from people in the FBI, such as Colleen Rowley and others, there were investigations which were being blocked by the Bush administration into al-Qaeda activity in the United States. And the question, of course, is why. And according to Shippers' contacts, they knew there was going to be some sort of attack. And so I take that and I put it with another, and there's another report from Germany. It was a German newspaper which is quite respected. I can't remember the name now. But they quoted German intelligence officials who basically in themselves were quoting a warning that was issued by Echelon, which is a international satellite surveillance system. I'm sure you've heard of it. It basically monitors all electronic communications around the world, and it's dominated by the United States, Britain, some other countries, I think like New Zealand, use it as well. But basically, it's a very powerful satellite system. It's everything which is any form of electronic communications, faxes, telephones, emails, is monitored. And this system basically issued warnings 6 months and then 3 months prior to September 11 attacks that Middle Eastern terrorists were planning on hijacking commercial planes and targeting, the quote was, key symbols of American and Israeli culture. That was the exact phrase from the report. And what was very important here was that the report specified that the US intelligence community had taken this to be very credible. It hadn't just said, okay, we've got so many warnings coming in and, you know, this is just one of them, we don't care. They'd actually said that it was taken very seriously by the community, and as a result, surveillance subsequently intensified. That was a quote from the report.